At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
But top journals in science can now charge more than $10,000 for an article processing fee because the market will bear it. First of all, the open access coupled with article processing charges, APCs, brings up an equity issue. That's called being a perfectly discriminating monopolist. You charge the high fees to people who can afford them.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. This is Patrick Georgioff, trauma surgeon at Duke University, and I'm joined by co-host Dr. Ayman Ali, who is a Duke General Surgery resident and surgical education fellow here at Behind the Knife. And today we're going to discuss a topic that impacts all of us, and that is the medical publishing industry. Now, who better to set the stage than the great medical parody artist, Dr. Glaucom Feckin?
Hey man, how's it going?
Oh, great. I just had a paper published.
Dude, congrats. That's awesome.
It was in a pretty prestigious journal too.
Oh, wow. They probably pay you pretty well for that.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
The journal. They published your paper. They must have paid you pretty well for it, right?
Oh, well, no, the journal doesn't pay you any money.
Yeah, but they're using your paper.
Yeah, so...
Well, like if you spent years writing a book, you sell the book, you get money for it.
Oh, well, I do get paid to do the research. You know, I get grant funding.
Oh, so the journal that publishes your paper, they give you grant money to actually do the research.
No, the grant money comes from the government. So the journal doesn't pay for the research or the content that they're publishing. Are they some kind of nonprofit?
Oh, no. The largest academic publishing companies make like $20 billion a year.
Really?
Yeah. Their profit margins are like 40%, which is higher than Google.
So why don't they pay you to publish your paper?
Well, I get something much more valuable than money.
What?
Prestige.
Well, why can't you have both?
Because it's not about the money.
All right. So we all know that it is, of course, not all about the money. However, the very wacky nature of this whole business and that model really makes you wonder how did we get here? And so to help us understand that, Ayman and I are pleased to welcome a very esteemed guest to Behind the Knife, Dr. Alan Deskey. So Dr. Deskey is a professor of medicine at the University of Toronto. He's former physician in chief at Mount Sinai Hospital and former head of the Division of Internal Medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Deskey received his BS from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, his MD from Harvard School of Medicine, and his PhD in economics from MIT. He has published over 300 papers, commentaries, and editorials in leading medical journals, and has served on the editorial board of the New England Journal of Medicine, and has acted as contributing writer for the Journal of the American Medical Association. And now, get this, the coolest part, Dr. Deskey has also received two Tony nominations as a producer for Jesus Christ Superstar and Come From Away. In 2023, Dr. Deskey published an article that was titled The Changing Medical Publishing Industry, Economics, Expansion, and Equity in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. So he is quite well-versed on this whole topic from each side of it. Dr. Deskey, welcome. We are pleased to have you.
Thank you, Patrick and Ayman. I'm pleased to be here.
So the landscape of medical publishing has undergone significant changes really over the last decade or two. And as the open access model has grown, the pay-to-publish model has helped large publishers maintain profit margins that are similar to that of Google, Apple, and Amazon. And the most unusual aspect of all of this, in terms of the business model, is how the whole scheme really works. And in the current model, the people who provide both the content and do the external peer review receive no direct payments from the publisher. The publishers, of course, generate revenue from this content. And the crazy thing is the funding agencies, like the universities and research institutes, those who actually pay the salaries of the investigators, then need to spend millions annually to buy back access to the work that they supported. Now, this is not to say that journals, even digital-only ones, do not provide important services that are costly, and they are largely related to labor costs associated with submission and editing and even production processing. With that said, the model is still truly bizarre and somewhat without comparison. Let's try to understand better how this all came to be. So, Dr. Detsky, can you start us off here by talking about the history of the medical publishing industry?
Sure, I'd be happy to do so. So the history of the modern publishing industry, particularly in science, began in the 1950s and was started by a man named Robert Maxwell, who coincidentally is Ghislain Maxwell's father. And he was a very shrewd and successful business person, entrepreneur in England, and he began something called Pergamon Press. And those companies took advantage of the market situation at that time, where there was a strong desire for promotion and development of science after World War II. And so it was very much in the interest of governments, particularly the US government, of universities, and of the scientists themselves to develop and disseminate their science through publication. And so these publishing companies were able to charge subscription fees, not only to the individuals who subscribe themselves, but also to the universities who were eager to buy them. And government was eager to fund them because dissemination and communication of research was the key towards technical progress. And so you might think that as more journals came online, there would be competition and the price would lower. But in fact, it went the opposite direction. The more journals that came on, the higher the prices got because scientists and universities couldn't just choose between journals. They had to subscribe to all of them. So that model went on for quite a long time, where individuals in science and institutions paid for subscriptions. And the medical publishing industry had also the advantage of advertising. In those days, printed copies were disseminated by drug companies as one of the best advertising techniques possible. And so they also curated a large revenue from drug companies in terms of advertising. But that all was disrupted by the thing that disrupted everyone, which was called the internet, which converted the industry from a primarily print version of dissemination to a primarily digital version of dissemination. And drug companies no longer could use preprints or actual copies of journals to do advertising. Advertising was more targeted through the digital media, which you might think would have been more efficient, but was in fact much less lucrative. And so that coupled with direct-to-consumer advertising really cut the legs out from under the tenet that was holding up revenue streams for journals, which was advertising. The next disruptor was the requirement for open access, so that major funding agencies would dictate that if you're going to accept a grant and publish, your research has to be available to everyone. So journals were then being forced to have open access, and the business model for open access was to shift the cost away from the publisher and actually on to the writers, the authors themselves. So the parity gets even worse. Not only did they not pay for the content, but you had to pay for the dissemination yourself, The article processing fee started out modestly at a couple of $100s. They've moved up to $1,000 to $2,000 or $3,000 for a low-level journal. But top journals in science can now charge more than $10,000 for an article processing fee because the market will bear it. The reason that scientists want to publish in these journals and are eager to pay those fees is because that's the currency by which their success is measured. Their own institutions look at the end of every year at an annual activity report, like we do in my institution, and ask, how many home runs did you have in publication? How many New England Journal papers? How many JAMA papers? How many Lancet papers? How many BMJ papers? How many science papers? How many Nature papers? And how many Cell papers? Those would be the key journals. I think I've captured most of them in biomedical research. And so authors will basically pay anything to get their papers published there. And what has followed along is a large number of open access journals, which can charge not as much as that, but can charge fees to keep themselves afloat. Now, let me just say one thing. The science publishing industry is very lucrative and has high profit margins, but that doesn't mean that each journal is profitable at the margin. So a journal that belongs to a small society, subspecialty society in surgery or medicine or psychiatry and radiology might have a limited audience, and their profit margins might be much smaller. And that's why they need to charge article processing fees in order to keep afloat. And the large conglomerate companies like Elsevier and Springer, and they purchase these journals, but they convert them very rapidly into journals that have far more publications, and they increase their article processing charges.
Something that I recently learned was just the scale of what you're talking about. That wasn't immediately obvious to me. You were talking about just how much open access there is now, but I learned that in 2002, there were 22 journals. And in 2021, there's 17,000. And that, I think, is shocking to me. I was wondering, what do you think is going to be in the future of this open access model? And is there a problem with just the scale?
So that brings up several points. First of all, the open access coupled with article processing charges, APCs, brings up an equity issue. On the one hand, it is equity increasing, because scientists and consumers around the world will not have to go behind firewalls, pay firewalls, to have access to published research. So that is an equity improving or equity increasing phenomenon. The equity decreasing phenomenon is that if you're a scientist in a country that doesn't have a lot of resources, or in an institution that doesn't have a lot of resources, or you could be Ayman Ali, Duke surgery resident, publishing a paper that needs to pay article processing charges at Duke, and they may think of you as, because there's wealth all around you. I understand Duke's a pretty fancy place. I visited there once. But you're a beginning investigator, so you don't actually have the $3,000 to scrape together, and you have to get your senior investigators or mentors to come up with the money, or departments. Now, in some cases, universities make deals with journals. And so what they will do is, not only when they buy the subscription for the journal, they also buy the article processing charges, either at zero rate or reduced rate for anybody that's affiliated with their institutions. But if you're not part of that, if you're just a scientist who discovers, like the Australian men who discovered the cause of ulcers was Helicobacter, I'll bet they were too, like, mom and pop show gastroenterologist. I don't know this for sure. And they might not have had any institutional resources to pay for it. That's quite a quaint story, if you know that story of the discovery of the infectious cause of ulcers. So this is the equity, the negative equity effects of open access and article processing charges. And it's certainly one that has to be addressed. Now, to be fair, journals do have mechanisms for you to apply to have those fees waived, which goes back to, like, that's almost my freshman economics class, microeconomics class. That's called being a perfectly discriminating monopolist. You charge the high fees to people who can afford them, and you charge lower fees to people who are willing to pay less, and you just scale it down all the way along and collect all of the monopoly rents. That's a classic economic, non-competitive market. And that's what this market is like. So those are the, that's the impact of, on equity of article processing charges and open access. The other aspect that you have alluded to, is there really all that's this much science out there that deserves to be published? Like if there used to be 200 journals and now there's 200,000 journals, isn't there diminishing returns to all these people? Like, are all these people actually producing valid and internally and externally valid research findings that we can adopt and improve healthcare? And that's actually not known. But one of the fears is that by having so many journals that the consumers of those journals will be unable to distinguish valid research from invalid research and even fraud, because we do know that exists in research. There's a long history, sordid history of fraudulent research being published and research that's just simply wrong, the not intentionally fraudulent, but mistaken because of bias and all kinds of other, and the play of chance. So there is concern that having so much published is going to dilute the nature of the science. That's another area that's concerned. I'm not so worried about that. I think that the market sorts itself out and people, like I'll use my own career. I've published maybe 300, 350 papers. And I've had a lot of papers in high-profile journals. I've been very blessed or lucky to have a lot of papers in high-profile journals. But I've also had papers in low-profile journals. And some of my most, the ones that I think are my most influential research papers were not published in the New England Journal or JAMA. They were published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, for example, a cardiac risk index project that I did when I first came to Toronto. And some of my favorite narrative medicine stories got published in the Journal of Hospital Medicine. So you don't always get your best work in the best journals. That's not how it works. So those, I think, are the concerns about the growing numbers of journals.
Yeah, to stick with that, you had mentioned that you're not worried about it, that the market per se will sort itself out. But as we talked about at the top of the show, this really isn't a normal market in any way, shape, or form based on the model that we have. Are you worried that volume just begets money, and this is a vicious cycle that the numbers will keep going up, up, and up, and everyone will want to get into the game? Or is there some breakpoint?
I don't worry about that. Whether I'd call it appropriate or not appropriate is not even, it's not the paradigm that I would use to talk about this. Although I have to say that I have two co-authors on that paper, Christopher Booth, who came up with the idea to do this. I think he came up with the idea because he's a medical oncologist at Queen's, a highly successful investigator who is now moving forward with something called common sense oncology, which is to get people to understand the real benefits of oncology therapies. And he's very smart. He was my student when he was a second year student. He came to do an elective with me. And he got pissed off because he sent an article into a journal that he used to support, a sort of a local medical oncology journal that used to be kind of a quaint place that everybody supported just because it was part of the community. And they had been bought out by, it's one of the stories we tell in our paper. And they'd been bought out by a conglomerate who then turned around and instead of publishing, I'll make up the number, 100 papers a year, published 2,000 papers a year. Instead of charging $600 article processing charges, they charged $2,000 article processing charges. And that sort of annoyed him. And he... the event that I think really pissed him off, I don't know if you can say pissed him off on a surgical.
You can say much more. Okay. Come hang on the OR for.
He submitted an article to a journal and they said, well, we don't want this, but our sister journal downstream might be interested. And by the way, if you go that route, they'll charge you $3,000. And he was like, well, why should I be paying $3,000? These are very profitable companies. And why am I footing the bill? Which is another equity question. The future that I see is, and that Chris and Joe Ross, who is at Yale, and Joe is one of the founders of MedArchives, so there's he fully understands the preprint platforms. This is what we see happening. And you pointed out from the top, I've been an author, I've been on an editorial board, I've been a contributing writer, and now I'm an associate editor or deputy editor at JGIM. So I've seen the publishing, and the only thing I haven't done has been on the print the print presser to put out the actual printed copies. So I've seen a lot of this industry over the course of my, well, I saw my first patient in 1976. So, and the viewers can't see, but I have gray hair. And so I've seen a lot of this. And I think that this is how it's going to unfold. And Joe and Chris and I came up with this paradigm. It wasn't, the idea wasn't original to me. The leading journals, the New England journals, the JAMAs, and New England Journal, I don't think charges article processing charges, but the some of the other ones do. The leading journals will exist into the future indefinitely. And that's because they will be the source of what is perceived to be the premier output of biomedical researchers. That will be where the best work will be done. And they can charge anything they want, and people will pay it. And for the most part, they will get people to do peer review. It's not just that the content is free, but the thing that makes peer review journals valuable, gives them their cachet, is the peer review part of it. And they also get that for free. The editors are often paid. I don't get paid at a small journal, but the peer reviewers do it for free. And now, as a deputy editor for Journal of General Internal Medicine, which I've been for maybe 5 years now, I can see how much harder it is to get people to do peer review. They just aren't willing to do it for a good reason. In the old days, they did it out of a sense of altruism and community contribution. And the secondary reason was they often thought, well, if I review this paper for you, maybe you'll be nicer to me when I send in my paper. That's actually completely untrue. There is no transactionality in this, but I think some people might be naive enough to think that. Even I think that sometimes. When I get a paper from the New England Journal and they want me to review it, I turn that down a lot less easily than from a lower level journal. But at the Journal of Internal Medicine, I used to have to put out 10 invitations to get two or three peer reviews. That would have been 5 years ago, pre-COVID. Now, I have to put out 25 invitations to get two or three reviewers. And most people just write back, flipping me the third finger. Who do you think you are asking me to spend my time on your paper? And I get that. I understand people are busy. Especially, it's challenging. It's challenging to be a junior faculty member. It's challenging to be a resident. People have families. They have the dog to watch, to walk. They have the baby to feed. Or they have parents to take care of. Or they have partners that need attention. Or they want to go on a date. So people are busy. I get that. So it's much harder to get the peer review that we want. And it's falling maybe on a smaller number of people who are willing to do that. So if the journals are charging article processing fees and the peer review isn't so forthcoming, it takes longer to get your articles reviewed at second tier and what I would call mom and pop journals, third tier journals, which don't have extensive staffs. And so I think the future is going to look like this. The top tier journals will always be in business and they can charge what the market will bear, which will go up and up and up. The second tier journals, scientists are going to say to themselves, do I really want to spend another year walking this through the Journal of General Internal Medicine and the Journal of Hospital Medicine and then and even the Canadian Journal of General Internal Medicine? Do I really want to spend a year going through three second tier or palm and pop journals? Why don't I just put it on a preprint server like MedArchives and call it a day? And it'll come out tomorrow. Well, like tomorrow instead of a year, and I can put it on my CV, and my department chair, who has changed from the gray-haired medical giants of the past to the hip social media technology adopters, early technology adopters, and they will say, you know what? It makes more sense to be efficient in your career. So why don't you try New England Journal, Annals of Internal Medicine, and call it a day. And just put it on MedArchives and put that. And we will count that as a peer-reviewed journal, the equivalent of a peer-reviewed journal. Because guess what? The peer review you get from a mom-and-pop journal ain't so great anyway. And MedArchives provides a different kind of peer review. Instead of the peer review being behind a wall that nobody can read it, although some journals do now publish their reviews, it'll show up on the internet as the comments that accompany your paper on MedArchives. And you can see what everybody thinks of your paper after the fact, instead of hiding the peer review. And I predict that the metric for promotion will change from any peer review journal to top tier peer review journals and just getting it out there. Now, will there be fraud when this happens? Absolutely, but there is now. Will there be work that is mistaken, conclusions that are honest mistakes? Well, there's tons of that now. Will there be crappy papers published? Well, even the New England Journal and JAMA on some occasions publish work that's fraudulent, that was discovered in that whole Africa thing during COVID, or is wrong. It turns out to be just plain wrong. And sometimes it's just the play of chance because these are experiments. And that'll happen anyway. Will it be worse? Will it be better? I don't know. But it might be more efficient for investigators. I have some friends in data science who that's what they do. They publish a paper on the data science equivalent of MedArchives. They put it in their CV with a link, and that's the citation. And I think that's where we're headed in medical publishing. The key variable here will be the leadership's recognition of the efficiency of doing this and encouraging their faculty to change from getting it into a peer review journal at any cost and saying, just try the top two and put it online afterwards. My academic background, as you noted, was in the Department of Economics at MIT, and they published a series called the White Papers in Economics from MIT. And you know what? It was not peer reviewed. It was not published. It was printed on mimeographs. And that was very prestigious to have a white paper in the economics series at MIT. And that's what I think we're going to go back to.
Yeah, I think that the alternative publishing options is really important and pretty relevant because, at least in the mathematics, the physics world, people publish things on archive all the time. And I know even in my sister's resume and things like that, she has citations to archive. And for them, it's almost as prestigious to a certain degree. And they treat it just like they would treat any other piece of research. So I wonder how long it will take for medicine. And do you think that we're getting there
It'll take, here's how long it'll take. It'll take as long as you get to be chair of surgery somewhere.
Fair.
The current generation of clinicians and scientists are digital natives, right? Or coming up as digital natives. And so this type of platform that you're talking about is really second nature. And if you can, Dr. Desi, expand a little bit on what MedArchives is and the social aspect of the quasi peer review, or at least the comments, that's very much in line with what we see on social media feeds day in and day out.
So I think I've only had two papers on MedArchives, and I've never actually looked at them. I know we sent them in. It would be my younger co-author said, "Why don't we just put this on MedArchives?" I'm the kind of guy who never gave up. Like, I might have 10 papers in my file fold in my filing cabinet where I wrote them and didn't publish them. I would go to the ends of the earth. So I was one of those guys. If it took me 4 years, I didn't care. I was very persistent. But Mike Frelich, one of my younger investigators, after two tries on a paper that we were working on, said, "Why don't we just put this on MedArchives?" And I was like, "Okay." Like, I mean, I knew what it was. So MedArchives is a preprint platform. They would not call themselves a journal. And it was started by Harlan Krumholz and Joe Ross at Yale. And it copied archives that was mentioned before. And there's another one, I think, called BioArchives or something like that. And the model is that you send your paper to them, to their site, and they adjudicate not the content of it, but there are some logistical things that you have to satisfy to make sure that it really is a paper. And I believe it's only research papers. There's no commentaries or reviews. It's just research. And if it passes through that screen, then it gets put up on a data site that is maintained by them called MedArchives that anybody can access, open access, and people can make comments on it. And so It's like social media with a lot more characters and a little bit of a filter at the beginning. And Joe and Harlan started this maybe 7 years ago, I'm guessing at that. And it has really exploded. And in fact, Joe told me that somebody once said to him, Joe, you're a, can you say this word on your show? Joe, you're a schmuck. Yeah, that's what my father would say. Why didn't you charge $50 a submission? If you had charged $50 a submission, you'd be rich now. And he said, that's true, but that wasn't the point. So they got, I believe they got grants to start this because it's not costless because they actually have to maintain the site and maintain the data. And there is some, as I mentioned, some filtering of it. And that's what it is. But this occurs in basic sciences like physics. And this occurs also in data sciences. This is not new. We in biomedical science are quite a bit behind the other scientific fields. And that doesn't totally surprise me. I wouldn't expect every field to look the same in academics.
Just to piggyback off that, the thing about archive is that it was always free. And same with medical archive as well. So one question I have for you is, when you pay to publish in some of these sister journals, for example, or open access journals, do you have any sense of what exactly their costs look like? And what they're charging for and what value they add to that process.
All right. Well, now I'm going to give you the answer that Robert Solow probably taught me when I took sophomore economics. The costs are anything you want them to be, because it depends on whether you're talking about the average cost, in which case you would take your total cost per year and divided by the number of papers that you put out there, or the marginal cost, which is how much does it cost you to put the last one out there, or whether you are a monopoly and can jack up the cost to any number you want it to be. So I could make that number be any number I want it to be. The costs that they are not recouping costs at the margin. Those dollars are much more than the cost of the margin, but they might also not be recouping their average costs, which might in fact be higher than that. So mm-hmm. there might be some subsidy, for example, from a professional journal or from prof. There might be cross subsidization from other journals, which are feeders. There might be relationships. So when they put out a number of $3,000, they're not putting out what their costs are. You can be right. sure of that. They're putting out what they think they can get out of you. And then they scale it back by offering people in low-income countries a waiver. They offer, oh, aren't we, like drug companies say, call us and we will, who makes Humira? AbbVie. Mm-hmm. I love their ads. Call us, AbbVie will make it free for you. Well, it's not free. You know it's not free. So what they're saying there is you can't afford to pay anything. So we will give it to you for free. We'll give it to the next guy for $10, the next guy for $100, and the next guy for $4,000. And the actual marginal cost of producing this might be $5. So what the number that they're putting out there is a reflection of what they think the market will bear. It's what they think the demand will cover. The actual cost can be any number you want it to be.
We talked about these outrageous profit margins of even 30 and 40%, like the big tech companies, and certainly not all journals. In fact, the vast majority probably are not making those types of margins. And so I imagine that it's not all sunshine and rainbows when it comes to money in and expenses. But to that end, there's also this proliferation of journals. So there has to be some type of economic incentive.
I might as well mention this here. We don't talk about this in our paper. In fact, we exclude these. But there is a category called predatory journals. Right. And I'm sure that both of you get emails from, okay. Hi, like they make up a name. The New England Journal of Almost Medicine, which makes it sound like the New England Journal of Medicine. We're the New England Journal of Almost Medicine. And we we've read your paper on publications and the publishing industry, and we would love to publish a paper of yours. Will you submit something to us? And by the way, it'll cost you $3,000 and you can put it on your CV. Those, I believe, are called predatory journals. And that's a huge growth industry in itself. Like they put nothing into it and it's all profit for them. That's not really what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about here is networks of journals that like JAMA down to JAMA Open, where JAMA doesn't charge a processing fee, but JAMA Open does. and or CMAJ, Canadian Medical Association Journal, does it. Well, actually, they do charge an article processing charge, and then they also have an open version of it as well. I'm talking about real journals that really do have some effort to have peer review in them. The other ones are not. But there's no barriers to entry for this.
Right.
Like, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I will. Many years ago, when I was on the editorial board of the New England Journal of Medicine, there were two really controversial events. I'm just going to tell you about one of them. The journal itself wanted to multiply. It was an entity of the Massachusetts Medical Society. It was, whether it had profits on the books or not, it was a lucrative entity for the Massachusetts Medical Society. And like the Wisconsin Medical Society wouldn't be as profitable because they don't have the Wisconsin Journal of Medicine that would be of equal stature to the New England Journal of Medicine. And they wanted to expand their brand and create sub-journals, New England Journal of Medicine, Internal Medicine, New England Journal of Medicine, Neurology, like that kind of thing. That those weren't the names they were going to use. And the editors at the time were Jerry Kassir, Marcia Angel, and Bud Relman was the past editor. They resisted that. They thought that was a bad move, that it would water down the product. And there was a big fight between the Massachusetts Medical Society and them. And ultimately, they didn't renew Jerry's contract. And at our editorial meeting, the editorial board was, of course, supportive of the current editors and said to themselves, well, maybe we should all quit and open up our own journal called whatever, brought to you by the former editorial board of the New England Journal of Medicine. And I said, nobody gives a fuck who we are. Like, they don't even know our names. Like, if we said brought to you by the former editors of the New England Journal editorial board, nobody would care about that. It's the brand that matters. And we wouldn't even be able to use that because we'd be infringing on their brand. So that idea is a non-starter. And that, and they changed editors. And, you know, Jerry had been in the job for 10 years and maybe it was time anyway. And Jeff Drazen came in and he has been, was an active promoter. He's a smart guy, like really good guy. He promoted this and developed it. And now he's passed it on to the next editor, Eric Rubin, and he's still involved. And they were able to leverage their reputation onto these lesser journals. They aren't as good. It's not as prestigious. They don't have the same quality of work, but they have the brand name. And so it is a vehicle for disseminating research, just as the JAMA group did. And it was a good idea. You know, JAMA originally had the sub-journals of JAMA were called the Archives of Internal Medicine. There was Journal of Medical Medicine Association, and then there was the Archives of Internal Medicine, which was also published by the American Medical Association. And quite smartly, many years ago, they said, that's not capitalizing on our brand. So why don't we change the name of that to JAMA Internal Medicine? And it was a brilliant move because then there was JAMA Surgery and JAMA Dermatology and JAMA Neurology, and that standardized the brand, which gave them, I think, better ability for the lesser journals to market themselves.
One last question I have for you is, for a resident today, let's say like me, you're doing a 2-year research fellowship, you want to publish a small paper, you have 2 years to do it. Let's say that I get rejected for some of the top ones that you spoke about. If I was to publish into a med archive scenario right now, how would that look if I'm applying to a fellowship or even at Duke today? Do you think that we're there now or not quite?
No, we are not there now because the fuddy-duddies who run academic medicine are still stuck in the old model for the most part.
Well, Dr. Desky, this has been a fantastic conversation. We really appreciate your time and having you on.
So this is Alan Detsky from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, signing off and telling you all to dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.